Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. Did a whiteboard video last night that I think is the most important whiteboard video I've ever done by far. And it is the most complex because it's dealing with how money is actually, or dollars are actually created, this money printing. It's such an ambiguous, overgeneralized term that it's almost like calling someone a racist in today's day and age. It doesn't even, what does that even mean? There really is no definition because people use it so broadly. Now, I think this is something that is absolutely vital, crucial that you understand. I don't think you can make good decisions for your portfolio unless you understand how dollars are created or what is happening to the amount of dollars in the real economy. How on earth can you understand macro if you don't understand money? Let me just put it to you that way. The answer is you can't. And it's led to some people that are incredibly smart making very, very bad predictions. I mean, go back to the GFC and think about how many people were literally predicting hyperinflation or extreme level, 20, 30% inflation because the Fed was expanding their balance sheet. Why? Why did they make those predictions? Because they didn't understand money. And again, I'm talking about dollars. And so I want to go in and explain that whiteboard video to the best of my ability to you guys right now. And I think this is going to be very evergreen as far as the content. And hopefully it's something that you can take this video, watch it several times, and then maybe combine it with watching the whiteboard video. And it'll really help you understand the mechanics behind what really goes on behind the scenes. And this will help you make far better decisions moving forward and also be able to better understand the probability of certain outcomes occurring in the real economy. And like I said in the video, the whiteboard video, if you can get your head around what I'm saying, you are going to know, literally, you are going to know more and have a better understanding of the monetary system than 99% of the people that work at the Fed. And you say, well, George, that might not, who cares? That's not a big deal. They're all dummies. To a certain extent, I would agree. Not all of them, but to take it a step further, you understand what we're talking about in this whiteboard video, and you will have a better understanding of the monetary system than I would argue 99% of the people, even on FinTwit. So let's get into this. And we're going to start with step number two, because step number one, I kind of just debunk a few things, and that doesn't, might help you learn, but it doesn't help you understand how the monetary system works. So when we're looking at quote unquote money printing, how we're going to define that is if the amount of dollars circulating in the real economy increases or decreases. Because that at the end of the day is what, people say, oh, well, the true definition of inflation is when the monetary supply. Okay, yeah, I get it. But when people talk, when people want to think this through, the answer they're trying to figure out 99% of the time is what's going to happen with consumer prices. That's really the bottom line. So, and then, other people say, oh, George, you're getting it all wrong because you're calling this money. Don't you know that gold and silver are the only money? Okay. Yes, I get it. Thank you for explaining that to me. But again, we're talking about the average Joe and Jane. They see this as money, or the reason that even most people that watch these videos try to understand the amount of dollars is because they're trying to understand the probability of consumer price inflation going up or down. And to what degree? So that said, we're going to focus on if M2 money supply. And I understand there's a poor measurement of overall money because we're not including the euro dollar system and what's happening in the shadows and blah, blah, blah. But for this video, so you understand the concepts, that's what we're going to use. And then we're also going to use M2 and broad money interchangeably. And then the third thing that we're going to use interchangeably, when we're talking about M2, when we're talking about broad money, we're just talking about that being a proxy for how many dollars are circulating in the real economy chasing goods and services. And another way to say that is how many dollars are on the balance sheet of non-bank entities in the real economy. Because the banking entities, okay, fine. You know, they could have a ton of dollars that are in the shadows and whatnot, but they're not buying cheeseburgers. They're not out paying rent. They're not out buying used cars and whatnot. So that money really isn't going to get out with too much velocity there. What's going to get out with velocity, again, are those dollars that are on the non-bank entity, especially the average Joe and Jane, not so much the financial institutions, because those would be non-bank entities as well. But I explain that in greater detail in the video. So we start here with treasuries, or the treasury. And I might have to take a break here in a second, guys, to get some water because my throat's really dry. But so we start with the treasury. This would be Janet Yellen right now. And let's say she is going to issue treasuries because they need to deficit spend. We've got your drunk insolvent Uncle Sam here. So the next question becomes, who is buying the treasuries at auction? This is what you have to decide, or what you have to research. Is it a bank or is it a non-bank entity? So let's look at what happens if a bank buys a treasury from Janet Yellen. What happens to M2 money supply? Well, it stays the same. Why? Because this is a transaction that occurs strictly on the liability side of the Fed's balance sheet and the asset side of the bank's balance sheet. And as you guys know from watching my videos, the dollars that circulate in the real economy are not assets of the bank. Like we just said, they are liabilities, because those are the assets of the average Joe and Jane. So what we have to be concerned with initially is, or the question we have to be concerned with initially, are the dollars that are or liabilities of the commercial banks, are they going up or down as a result of this transaction? And the answer is nothing, because they're not involved with this transaction. Now, contrast this to if a non-bank buys a treasury from Janet Yellen. Well, in this case, what are they using to buy the money? Or excuse me, what are they using to buy the treasury? They're using dollars. Though, in other words, they're using commercial bank liabilities. So if they buy a treasury, then the amount of M2 broad money is going to decrease, right? So quick recap, if a bank buys a treasury from the treasury, nothing happens to M2. If a non-bank, M2 actually decreases. Okay, but there's a second step to the process. Janet Yellen will spend the money out of her account, the treasury's account. In this case, it's the TGA. And the TGA is a liability of the Fed. So in other words, it's on the Fed's balance sheet. So going down here, see, this is step one of the process. The treasuries are purchased. Step two of the process is the dollars are spent into, or she sends out the stimmy checks. Let's just use it as an example. So now we're dealing with a transaction that, regardless of whether it's a banking entity or non-banking entity, it is going to affect broad money, because those checks are going to be deposited in commercial banks. And if the checks are deposited in commercial banks, that is going to increase the bank's liabilities. Therefore, increase the amount of dollars that are on the asset side of the non-bank balance sheet. In other words, increase the amount of dollars that are circulating in the real economy chasing goods and services. So how this transaction works on the Fed's balance sheet is, regardless of what party actually buys the treasuries, the reserves go from the account for the applicable bank. And again, if it's a non-bank, that would be whatever bank they're using, whatever, wherever their checking account is. It would go from the reserve account of that bank into the TGA. Then what happens when the money is spent? Those bank reserves go from the TGA back into the reserve account of the bank wherever the checks are deposited. And so, just to reiterate, once the money is spent, that is a plus. That is an addition to M2 or broad money, regardless of whether the treasuries were initially purchased by the bank or a non-bank. So then it's just a simple equation. If we start with no impact on M2 and we end with a impact or a positive impact on M2, then on net balance, there would be a positive impact. Basically, 0 plus 1 is 1. Now, here, we start with a negative. So let's just say a negative 1. But then the second phase is we have a positive 1. So this would net out and be a wash. So we can safely conclude that if a bank buys a treasury, once the money is spent, then this would be an increase in addition to the overall money supply, dollar supply, if you will. If a non-bank buys the treasury in the first place, when everything is said and done, this would be a net wash. Now, there is a caveat. The money, or the checks, let's say, that Janet Yellen sends out need to be sent to non-bank entities. Why? Because that's what affects broad money or the liability side of the commercial bank's balance sheet. If these checks go directly back to the banks, then it does not affect M2. So in this whole process that I just explained, we are assuming that those checks are going to non-bank entities in the real economy. Now, hopefully right now, your first takeaway is, wow, George, this is complex. And it is true. The devil's in the details. I don't want that to discourage you from trying to learn this, because I mean this with 100% sincerity. If I can understand this, you can too. It just takes effort. I did not just wake up one morning and this just, I just thought of this in 5 seconds. This took me weeks of thinking through on my legal pad, which is right here, on the whiteboard, talking to people like Joseph Wang and Snyder and Alf and Lynn and inadvertently Emil and whatnot through his videos with Jeff. This took me a lot of hard work to figure this out. So, but it's worth it. And I guarantee you, if you take the time and energy to understand this, and hopefully I've been able to reduce your learning curve, you will be, it's like having a sixth sense, or it's like being one of the X-Men where you've got a special power and you can predict the future so much easier. You know, a lot of people say, or kind of wonder as to, I don't make a lot of predictions, as you guys know. But I do talk a lot of about a lot of things that have come to fruition in the past 2 years since I started this YouTube channel. And the only way I'm able to do that is just because I think I understand things a little bit better than most people, because I like knowing how stuff works. If I don't know how something works, it really bothers me. And I just get very obsessed until I figure out how it works. And I think because I might understand the nuance to macroeconomics a little bit better, it helps me understand the probabilities of future events a little bit better. It's an edge. And I think I want you to have that edge as well. And I just want you to know, again, that if I can do it, you can do it with a little bit of effort. So, but this does not end here, guys. This is just the tip of the iceberg. So let's keep going. It gets even more fun. If we, let's use another visual to kind of understand why M2 money supply would increase always increases once the Treasury spends the money or sends the checks back out to the non-banks, regardless of where the treasuries were purchased in the first place. The question is whether or not the treasuries were purchased in a manner that does not impact M2 or does impact M2. So let's just say this is the aggregate total of the balance sheets of non-bank entities, and it starts with dollars right here on the asset side. Again, those are liabilities of the commercial banks. They're going to buy the treasury. So we're just deleting the dollars. Those the account of whomever buys just is decreased by the amount of the transaction. So that those dollars are going to be replaced by treasuries. Pretty straightforward. And then when Janet Yellen sends out those stimmy checks, now all of a sudden there are dollars on the balance sheets, the same, let's just say the same amount of dollars, and there is a treasury. So we can see this in real time as far as this process of M2 money supply with the transactions occurring originally with the non-banks, where there is a net wash because you have a decrease in M2 money supply right here, right? These dollars are here at the beginning, treasury purchased, no more dollars. So there's no more dollars, M2 money supply has shrank. But when the stimmy checks go out, the checks are deposited, and again, those dollars reappear. But they're not more dollars, they're the same amount of dollars. And again, that's why M2 money supply stays the same. So this is kind of a visual that's maybe better explaining what's happening in this process with the non-bank entities and the treasury. Now let's go over to another visual that I think will help you understand this a lot better and kind of like a cheat sheet. We've got to draw a line in the sand between banking entities and non-banks, like you saw over here. Now, the cheat sheet is if the transaction is happening between banks, and at the end of the day, the Fed is a bank, then it isn't going to impact M2 money supply directly. Now, it may increase the balance sheet capacity. We're going to get into that in a moment. But just the transaction in and of itself isn't going to impact M2. Likewise, if the transaction occurs between non-banks, it too isn't going to impact the money supply because let's just say this hedge fund is buying a treasury from the average Joe. Well, the hedge fund's bank account is going to be deducted by however much the treasury is. And the average Joe's bank account is going to be increased by the amount of the money that he is receiving from the hedge fund itself. So it's just a decrease here, an increase here. So on net balance, it doesn't matter. Where it really matters is if the banking entity buys something from a non-bank or vice versa. And again, it doesn't matter whether it's a bank or the Fed, assuming this bank has an account with the Fed. So the cheat sheet here is if a banking entity buys an asset from a non-bank, that increases M2. Because how is this bank going to buy this treasury from the average Joe? Well, they're going to have to increase the average Joe's balance in their checking account. Well, if their checking account goes up, then if they're not getting that money from a decrease in someone else's checking account, then on that balance it goes up, right? But the reverse decreases M2. So if the average Joe buys a treasury from the bank, then the bank reduces his checking account by the amount of the transaction, and therefore M2 decreases. So once you get your head around this, and then all of this gets a lot easier. So now let's go through a quick quiz and just to make sure we're all on the same page. And then we'll get on to step three, which believe it or not is even more complex. So quiz question is does all government spending increase M2 money supply? The answer, no. Only if the buyer is a bank and the receiver of the deposit is a non-bank. Question number two, does all QE equal an increase in M2 money supply? No. Only if the seller is a non-bank entity. Why? Because the seller is a non-bank and they are selling to because they're a non-bank and they're selling an asset to a bank, in this case, the Fed. And this happens, by the way, via primary dealers. But even if the primary dealer is in the middle of the transaction, it doesn't impact anything. So again, does all QE equal an increase in M2 money supply? No, only if the seller is a non-bank, because then the Fed buys from the average Joe, the Fed's a bank, therefore it goes back to this equation. If any bank buys from a non-bank, M2 up. There you go. So now let's move on to, let me go out of this here and let me see how incredibly I'm boring all of you to death. All right, we still got 343 people on, so I'll keep going. And again, my objective here is to do this as thoroughly as possible. So this is kind of evergreen content, so you guys can come back in the future and just review this and maybe you know, watch it a few more times to digest, and then also combine that with the whiteboard video I did last night, and then you'll really grasp what we're talking about. Let's go to step three, and this is where it gets really fun. So now let's go on to some common arguments that you hear on social media, and I'm sure maybe some of your friends and family member Fred's, and let's kind of just go through those through this lens of money printing, so we can better understand the system in total. And I'm going to talk about the global monetary system. So first of all, or the first common argument you hear, is quantitative easing increases banks' balance sheet capacity. And this is something that I've said on numerous occasions, but I always try to say that it increases, the only thing it could do is increase the balance sheet capacity of the banks, but the balance sheet, they're not balance sheet constrained. And if I don't say that, then that's my mistake and I apologize. I always try to follow it up with that to be clear. So again, the argument here is that, well, yeah, the Fed doesn't technically print money, but it doesn't matter because this QE process where they're buying treasuries and they're buying treasuries by increasing bank reserves, that is, then the banks are going to take that money and they're going to lend it out to the real economy, and there's going to be a multiplier effect and a 10% reserve requirement. So therefore, if the Fed buys $1 in treasuries, that's going to increase bank lending by $10, and that's going to be money in the real economy. So effectively, the Fed is directly impacting the amount of dollars in the real economy. Wrong. And it's wrong because it assumes that there's actually a constraint on the balance sheet. And for most people, 99% of the people that think they know this stuff, they'd say, well, there is, George, because there's a 10% reserve requirement. Therefore, the bank has to have the bank reserves or the cash equivalent to back up a deposit. So if they have a $100 deposit, they have to have $10. This goes back prior to the Cervasa sickness when we actually had a 10% reserve requirement. And in that way, that would be the argument as to why the Fed actually does control the amount of dollars that are circulating in the real economy. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macro economics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. What they don't understand is this is just basic accounting shenanigans from the banks to be able to get around that rule. This rule is like the mask mandate here in Colombia. It's nonsense. It's sure it's on the books, but no one pays any attention to it. So effectively, it isn't a rule at all. And again, this precedes Cervasa sickness in March, because they just did away with the rule because it didn't make any difference anyway. Here's why, guys. Let me walk you through this. So this is a bank that has a 10% reserve requirement. This is a bank outside of the United States, let's just say in the Eurodollar system. Could be a subsidiary bank, most likely, that has zero reserve requirement. And so we start off with the balance sheets, assets, liabilities, and they have a bank reserve or reserves for $10. And you can't see because my hand's in the way. Oh, here you go. You can see that. They're $10. And then they have deposits for $100. So they are abiding by this 10% reserve requirement so far. And then let's say that they've got a treasury on the asset side of the balance sheet that equals $90. So we've got $100 on the assets, $100 liabilities. Okay, next step, let's say that they want to create an additional loan for $100. They see a great opportunity to make money. But most people say, oh, well, they can't do it, George. There you go. Can't do it. Because if they added, let's say, another loan for $100, that would be increasing their deposits by $100. And they only have $10. They would need $20 to back up these deposits because there's $200 in deposits. Therefore, they're screwed. That's just an example of how their balance sheet is constrained. And why, if they didn't have this treasury and they had another bank reserve by quantitative easing, all of a sudden the Fed has increased their balance sheet capacity. Again, nonsense. Here's why. What they can do and what they usually do, they could do 1,000 different things, but this is one easy thing. They just take this deposit and they just transfer it over to the subsidiary bank. And so, as you guys know, this is a liability, so they would have to transfer them an asset as well. What's the asset? Well, they can't transfer bank reserves. They could just transfer them an IOU, like accounts receivable, accounts payable. This just happens on the ledger between the two banks, the ghost ledger, if you want to call it that. And so then the asset on the subsidiary bank's balance sheet would be the IOU for $100. And then the liability on the original bank's balance sheet would go from the deposit to now it's an IOU, which technically is a deposit, but it's not really a customer deposit. It's more of a wholesale type of accounts payable. And so this gets around the law. So now all of a sudden you still have the $100 loan, but you've replaced it with $100 something, another liability that isn't a deposit. Let's just put it that way. And wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. You now fall. Now you're obeying the rules. You fall within the regulatory restraints, or what are supposed to be these regulatory restraints. You have abided by those, and there's no problem. Go ahead and move forward and continue to make loans. Now, another very easy thing they could do is just go into the repo market or, overnight money market between the banks, the interbank lending. But just an example with repo, although a bank probably wouldn't use that, but let's just say they did. Then they just take the treasury that they had, and that goes, they can use that as collateral, but actually that stays on their balance sheet. Most people think that repo is a collateralized loan, which technically it is, but usually the treasury, the collateral stays on the bank's balance sheet that's doing the borrowing. So that's why I just put another IOU here. So what happens is you've got the new loan for 100, you've got the $100 deposit, which is new, and so to abide by the law or the rules, what they would do is they just take this treasury, stays on their balance sheet, but effectively they go and they give the IOU to the counterparty in the repo market. The counterparty gives them the bank reserves for $10. So this they've got a new IOU on the liability side of their balance sheet for $10. They've got the new bank reserves for $10, and this $10 in bank reserves backs up the new $100 deposit. And the original $10 in bank reserves backs up the original $10 deposit. Everything's in line. They're ready to go, and they're abiding by the 10% reserve requirement. No problem. So you can see, and I'm just going over two very simple things here, guys, that the banks have hundreds of ways that they could really, let's just say, manage their balance sheet to create as many loans as they want to, regardless of whether they're in the United States or outside of the United States. Now, so this just shows that there really is no constraint on the bank's balance sheet, at least not a regulatory constraint. And the amount of bank reserves they have really doesn't give them any more lending power, because they had all the lending power they needed prior to the quantitative easing. So now let's go over and look at what happens to the treasuries that are on their balance sheet, because this also assumes that those treasuries that the Fed bought from the banks in the process of quantitative easing was illiquid. So think about this. Let's go back to this example where they've got the $10 in bank reserves, $100 deposit, $90 in treasuries, and they want to create another $100 deposit. Okay, fine. Why wouldn't they just sell the treasury? Okay, sell. And what do you get for that treasury? More bank reserves. Woohoo! You can go ahead and make more deposits. So if they had the treasury on their balance sheet to begin with, why wouldn't they just sell it? Why is there some sort of magic that happens when the Fed replaces that treasury with bank reserves, when the bank, if they wanted to, they could have done that quite literally instantly on the open market? That doesn't make any sense. All right, moving on. QE, let's see. Rates go down, therefore lending goes up. Okay, well here we just look at a simple chart of QE versus the 10-year yield. So this is a chart of QE and the 10-year yield. So green is when they start QE or end it, and the blue line is the interest rate or yield on the 10-year. So you can see when they started QE1, the yield was here. When they ended it, it was down. No. Up. Interest rates went up when they did QE1, not down. Here we go. Let's go over to QE2. Rates start here. Rates end here. Up. Well, let's go to QE3. Rates start here. Rates end there. So the idea that the Fed reduces interest rates by doing quantitative easing, therefore, the amount of lending in the real economy or dollars created increases, is nonsense. It's just pure nonsense. It could work that way, but it might not. There's really no correlation whatsoever. Now, you could say that interest rates in general are down. Okay, maybe there's an argument there, but there is no inverse relationship that you would expect with the Fed's balance sheet and yields on the 10-year or in the real economy. And then the next thing is they say, well, if interest rates go down, then that increases demand for loans. People are going to take out more loans. Okay, maybe, but maybe not. If their income couldn't service the loan because their balance sheet was already too levered up, then or maybe, you know, most people would take out a loan to buy a house. Well, maybe house prices go up so high they can't afford the house because of their income. Therefore, you have demand for loans actually go down, even if interest rates were extremely low. So I'm not saying that lower interest rates don't increase demand. I'm just saying not always. And then you also have to look at the risk reward for the banks. So just because there's more demand for loans doesn't mean that the banks are going to lend. The risk reward in the broad economy has to make sense. And the individual has to be creditworthy. Great examples I can give of both of these is back in 2012 when I started investing in real estate. Back then, real estate was persona non grata. The banks didn't want anything to do with lending on real estate. The risk reward didn't make sense. What were the interest rates back in 2012? The Fed had them pegged at zero on the Fed funds. So interest rates were really low. Does that mean that the banks were lending more? No, they were lending less. And so this is just an example of how there isn't always this relationship that's tied at the hip. And now where this gets into further nuance is if the Fed is buying mortgage-backed securities or corporate debt, then I think there could be an argument. Again, not always, but there could be an argument that banks will lend more, even regardless of the interest rate, because you're massively reducing their risk, if not taking it down to zero. So then the next thing that I wanted to go over that I think a lot of people struggle with is they say, okay, George, I get what you're saying, but most of the money printing is a result of banks lending it into existence. And yes, the government and the Fed, they impact M2 on the margins, but most people don't understand that the nuance to how they do or how they don't. And we just went over that in step number two. But what I don't understand is if the banks can create their own money, quote unquote, why don't they just print all of this money, give it to themselves or lend it to another bank, and then they just be rich or they can bail themselves out? And this is a good question. And the answer is they can. They absolutely can. But just because they can doesn't mean they will. And to explain this, we've got to go to the next whiteboard. Okay, this is clear enough. So let's just think about this. If two banks were in cahoots and they decided just to lend each other $1 billion and then they're both rich, how would this work on their balance sheet? So you can't see it here, but I've got, this is Bank A, Bank B, and Bank C. And Bank C is not in cahoots with Bank A and B. So what would happen to their balance sheets is there would be, on Bank A, there would be an additional asset because they're lending Bank B $1 billion. And then they would have a deposit because Bank B lent Bank A $1 billion. And then they would also have a deposit liability because the money that they, the $1 billion that they just lent Bank B would be their liability, Bank A. And then they would also have a liability because they technically borrowed the money. Therefore, there is a loan that they have to repay Bank B. And then Bank B's balance sheet would be the exact same. So now all of a sudden, the main key important thing here is that Bank A now has this $1 billion that they didn't have before. Bank B has this $1 billion that they didn't have before. But remember that this $1 billion of their asset is a liability of Bank B, and Bank B's new asset for $1 billion is a liability of Bank A. Okay, so then what we can do just through accounting is you can just cross off the loans because they kind of cancel each other out. So then the balance sheets look like this, just the deposits. The deposit asset for $1 billion and the deposit liability for $1 billion. Okay, but now let's say that Bank A decides to actually use the $1 billion. Why create it and get rich if you can't spend it? So let's say they buy a property from the average Joe, and this property is on the asset, but you can't see it because my hand is covering it. Trust me, there's a little stick figure house there. And let's say that the average Joe banks with Bank C, which again is not in cahoots with Bank B and A and B. So how would they pay for this $1 billion? Well, they would use the deposit, that's the asset, which is the liability. So if Bank B has to send that $1 billion liability, which is the asset of Bank A, over to Bank C to pay for the property, they also have to send them an offsetting asset, which would be their $1 billion asset. So now Bank B is screwed. Well, they started with this great plan, but now they don't have any money because stupid Bank A spent the money. Now, this isn't a big deal because they could just do another loan. And with the next loan or couple loans, then Bank B could spend the money and they could buy a $1 billion property. The reason this doesn't work is when you get over and think through what happens from the standpoint of Bank C. Because now Bank C has been given an additional $1 billion liability. That's a big deal. But they're also given this $1 billion asset. But the only reason they would take this asset is if they trusted Bank A, if they didn't think there was any counterparty risk. Because this asset, remember, is a liability of Bank A. And if Bank C looks at Bank A and says, whoa, wait a minute here, you guys are just pulling these shenanigans between each other. I don't trust your balance sheet. I'm not going to take this asset. What do you, get it out of here. This is garbage. This is a mortgage-backed security in 2009. And if I'm not going to take your asset, then there's no way in hell I'm going to take your liability. So therefore, you can't buy anything. Now, if this asset that they were transferring over, let's say, they would be Bank B. If they're transferring over a treasury, well, then that's different. They're going to take that every time because there's no counterparty risk. Or if it's a bank reserve, great, no counterparty risk in the bank's eyes. You see? But here what they've done is they've tried to transfer a liability that a bank can create and where there is significant counterparty risk. Or they've tried to transfer an asset that is a liability of the bank that effectively is the counterparty. So what this boils down to is the only way that this could happen is if the counterparty risk in the marketplace was incredibly low. And usually that's not going to happen. I mean, if you were the bank, think about it in those terms. Would you take this? Let's say you've got a buddy that is always borrowing money and he's always broke. And he says, oh yeah, here's an IOU for $1,000. No, I don't think so. But just sell me your motorcycle. No, not going to happen. Because I don't trust, you're not good for the $1,000. But if he gave you $1,000 gold bar, then you'd say, sure, okay, here, I'll take it. No problem. You see, that's the difference here, guys. And so what's the big idea? What's the takeaway here? And a lot of people in the comments asked me to take this video and do the same thing by describing the Eurodollar market. But what they don't understand is I just did. This is the Eurodollar market. And this is why this is what broke, by the way. Remember, you know how Jeff Snyder always says that the Eurodollar market broke in August of 2008 and it's never been repaired. This is what he's talking about right here. He's just talking about the confidence or the perceived counterparty risk from Bank C to Bank A or from Bank C to Bank B. You see, prior to the GFC, all these banks trusted each other. Effectively, they're all in cahoots. That's why you can have money supply, global dollar supply, increase at such a rapid rate, even though there's only $40 billion of reserves on the Fed's balance sheet. That's why. But then afterwards, after the GFC, after everything collapses, this whole system falls apart. And now none of the banks are in cahoots because none of them trust each other because they don't trust the system. And therefore, the Fed has to take their balance sheet to infinity and beyond to make up for all of the banking activity that is not happening in the shadows. You see? So the conclusion here and the big idea is that, yes, governments and the Fed, and in tandem sometimes not, can affect broad money, or let's call it the dollar supply globally, on the margins. But real money printing, the money printing that really matters, and that's the money printing that happens in the euro dollar market, has nothing to do with the Fed. It has everything to do with banks' balance sheet management plus perceived counterparty risk. At the end of the day, that is all money is. That's all it is. Or dollars, if you want to use that term. All money is, what normies think of as money is nothing more than commercial banks' balance sheet management plus perceived counterparty risk. That's it. And once you get your head around that, you are going to, it's going to be a superpower, and you are going to be able to understand macro 10 times better than not only you could before, but I would argue pretty much 99% of the people at the Fed. So I'll leave it there. I don't want to risk being too redundant. And I think I've explained it to the best of my ability. Hopefully my ability to explain this will get better in the future as I review these topics. But this gives you kind of an evergreen video to go along with the whiteboard video, which I'm hoping will be evergreen to reference and to really just play back, absorb, and really take your understanding of the monetary system to the next level. Okay, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. As always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism.